We have some really good Bible classes at our congregation here. And when you really get into reading the Bible, studying the Bible, you start sometimes comparing how different translations might read. Or if you're reading through, you might, in some Bibles, have a footnote that'll say, you know, this might be an alternate sort of a reading. Or you might have something that's in brackets or in parentheses, and it'll say, you know, certain manuscripts omit these verses. And so, what is all that about? And that's what I hope that we can think about for a few weeks on Sunday night. We're going to start in very big, broad terms tonight, just kind of talking about what is the Bible? What is this book that we have? And then try to zero in or focus more in on some of the different translations that we might use and do a little bit of a historical survey over a few weeks of some of our different English translations and Bibles and where they come from. And hopefully this will be one of those things that's enjoyable. I don't ever want to be just a lecturer kind of a, you know, presentation. So I hope that this is something that's actually enjoyable and engaging and profitable for us too. So when we think about the Bible, the thing that we call the Bible, you know, what is this? When we call it a Bible, what does that word even mean? That word comes from Greek and Latin, and it means a book. Or if it was in the plural, it would be books. So we've got a book. And we call it a holy Bible. Holy meaning something that's different, something that's set apart, something that's different from the rest of the things that are like that thing. And so to call it a holy Bible really means something like a book that's not like other books. We have a book, but this book is not like all the other books that we might pick up. This book itself is actually many books. It's one book, but in our English Bibles, we have 66 books. 39 in the Old Testament, 27 in the New. I can remember when some of the first, if you want to call them, you know, e-readers or the, you know, electronic book kind of thing first started coming out, the Kindle and all of that. And somebody might say, well, I've got 45 books on this thing, or I've got 50 books on here. And people would say, wow, that's a lot of books to carry around with you. In our Bibles, we have 66 books. We could say, I've got 66 books in here. And you'd be telling the truth. These are books that span a wide range of years when they were written, authors, places, a great diversity of books, and yet all telling a single story, as we just finished talking about on Sunday nights. And so we think about our Bibles as being Old Testament and New Testament. That word testament is a word that we don't use all that often. And that also comes from a Latin word. What we might be more familiar with is the word covenant. It might be more understandable for us to talk about the books relating to the Old Covenant and then the books that are dealing with the New Covenant. Some of the books are dealing with Israel and the people of the Old Covenant. Some of them are then Jesus and the church and the New Covenant. So we have books of the Old Covenant, books of the New Covenant. So in our Bibles, how are these books arranged in the Bibles that we have? Well, when we think about the Old Testament, our Old Testament is arranged first with what some would call the Pentateuch, which would be five, or, you know, Pentagon is five, the Penta. So five books: Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. The five books of law. Some call them five books of Moses. After that, the way that our English Bibles are arranged is what's been classified as books of history. So it then goes from Joshua, Judges, all the way through to the time of Esther. And these have been categorized as some by books of history. We then have what tends to be labeled books of poetry and wisdom. So we have Job, which is that, although we sometimes maybe don't think about it that way, but we have Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. And then in our English Bibles, we have the prophets. We have what we call the major prophets, which are just the longer ones, and then what we tend to call the minor prophets, which are the shorter ones. So from Isaiah to Malachi. And I've kept saying in our English Bibles, because that's what our Bibles would be considered. They are translated in English. They tend to be arranged in that standard way. In Hebrew Bibles, what we would call the Old Testament, if you look at a Hebrew Bible, what a Jewish person might be reading out of, it's arranged a little bit different. They think of the arrangement as being three parts. What they call the law, the prophets, and the writings. So the law would be those five books, the first five that we have. The prophets would be the prophets, but also some of the books that we would call books of history. And we mentioned that when we talked about Kings. We think about Kings as a book of history. Within Jewish thought, Kings is thought of as one of the books of the prophets. Well, why is that? It's about Elijah. It's about Elisha. It's about a host of other prophets. So they think about some of the books we categorize as history as being books of the prophets from the standpoint that you've got prophets in those books. There's a prophetic message in those books. And then the writings is just everything else that doesn't fall under the law or the prophets. And if you then translate, or technically you'd call it transliterate, but if the way that law, we would pronounce that in our English language would be the Torah or the Torah. And then the prophets, they would say it Nevi'im and then the Ketuvim. And they use that acronym to call this the Tanakh. So if you're talking to, let's say you have a Jewish friend, and you're talking to your Jewish friend, and your Jewish friend asks you tomorrow, hey, did you all read from the Tanakh yesterday? You can say, well, sure, we read from Genesis, or we read from Exodus, or Isaiah, or Malachi. It's how they refer to what we call the Old Testament. So if you ever hear anything about the Tanakh, or read about the Tanakh or come across that, that's what it's talking about. And that's how it's titled that within Jewish conversations. So we've got what we call the Old Testament. Well, then we get into the New Testament. How are our New Testaments arranged in our Bibles? It starts with the Gospels, the four Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. We then have Acts, the Acts of the Apostles is what that is short for in our Bibles. We often will call Acts early church history, which it certainly is. But where that title comes from in our Bibles is the Acts of the Apostles. These are the things the apostles went on to do after Jesus was no longer with them. We then have the letters of Paul to the churches, which is Romans to 2 Thessalonians. These roughly are organized by length, which was a way of cataloging books in ancient times, roughly according to length. So Romans is much longer than 2 Thessalonians. Doesn't have that much to do with the dating of it or that kind of thing. It's more so according to the length. We then have letters of Paul to individuals. Again, roughly according to length. 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, Titus, and then the shortest of all, Philemon. And then what tends to be called the general letters or the general epistles. And aside from Hebrews, these are according to the name of the author. So whereas Paul's letters are according to the church being written to. And for example, we don't have 1st and 2nd and 3rd and 4th and 5th and 6th and 7th and 8th and 9th, Paul. Those are according to places. These letters are titled according to the author it's associated with. So 1st and 2nd Peter or James, 1st and 2nd, 3rd John, Jude. And then we have the book of Revelation. And when we think about the Old Testament and the New Testament, the word that's used to talk about those two collections of books, or the one big collection of books, is the canon. So this isn't the canon that is used in war and shoots cannonballs out of. This word comes from something like the word for cane, or a reed, something that's like a stick that you could use to measure something. And so this is a collection of books that a group recognizes as being authoritative. This is the canon. So you could talk about the canon of the Old Testament, or the canon of the New Testament, or the canon of the Bible as a whole. These are the decided upon books that are going to be viewed as authoritative for our practice. So, when we think about, how did all this come to be? In terms of the collection of these books and those sorts of things. With the Old Testament, we don't have as much information or know as much about when, for example, when did the first five books, when did those come to be acknowledged and that was accepted? And then when did Joshua reach the form that we have it in? And we don't know as much about some of the Old Testament sorts of things. But there's an interesting passage in the Gospel of Luke. In Luke 24 and verse 44, where Jesus says, "These are my words which I spoke to you while I was still with you, that all the things that are written about me in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms must be fulfilled." Jesus would seem to be referencing what we could call some sort of a canon, some sort of an agreed upon books. You've got the law of Moses, there's the prophets, there's the Psalms. When we think about the Old Testament, the books that we have, how those books came together, there probably hasn't been any finding of more significance in the last few hundred years than the Dead Sea Scrolls. So the legend about the Dead Sea Scrolls is that there's this shepherd boy who's out, and he stumbles across these caves. He throws a rock into one of the caves, and he hears pottery breaking, which then leads to this investigation of what was it that shattered. And that's the legend, at least, behind the beginning of this. But what happens with the Dead Sea Scrolls is there's all these documents that are very, very old that nobody had come across yet. And there's some different thoughts about the dating of them. Generally, it's thought that some of the oldest are about 250 B.C., so the interesting thing about this is that you've got some writings that are believed to be around 250 before Christ. And there was a pretty agreed upon Hebrew text of the Old Testament from around 1000 or so AD. That was agreed upon. This is, you know, these are good translations, that sort of a thing. And what was found was that there was remarkable consistency and stability from these writings dated around 250 BC to the writings that were known from about 1000 AD. And you stop and think about that. In the days of handwriting and copying, these aren't days of printers and pictures and all of that. For writings generally to be very stable and very consistent for over 1,000 years is just a remarkable thing to think about. I wanted to try to do something here, so we'll see if it works. And some of this may be hard, difficult for some of you to see if you're in the very back. This is on Wikipedia, which Wikipedia actually has become a fairly good source. So back in the early days, people made fun of Wikipedia, but it's gotten pretty good, or much better. And what they have here is the different caves that were found. There were 11 caves, and this is a just kind of categorizing of that. And so just to kind of scroll through, there's lots from Isaiah. There's Habakkuk. There's fragments from Genesis, several, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, Judges, 2 Samuel, a whole bunch more from Isaiah, Ezekiel, the Psalms, Deuteronomy. Okay, so you move on to Cave 2. We won't flip through all of this, but Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, pieces from Numbers. Which is an interesting thing to think about, too. When we talk about all these things, a lot of times what are being considered are fragments. Sometimes large portions are found, but oftentimes it's, you know, a portion here, you know, a portion here, portion over there. And then it's somebody's job to try to reconstruct it. And we'll talk about that just a little bit tonight. So we have Cave 3, Ezekiel, Psalm, Lamentations, Isaiah. Here's some pictures of different fragments. Genesis, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, Song of Songs, or Song of Solomon, Daniel. So we won't flip through all of that. But if you're interested, you could go and look at that a little more on your own time. But it's a pretty interesting thing to think about. So at least in terms of the Old Testament text, that was a huge find. And so now there's all these, you know, fragments and copies and, you know, some of the texts that, you know, and this was in the 1940s. And so now translators have a lot of that to go and compare and contrast and, you know, maybe in some verses try to find a little bit better reading than what was had before and, you know, all of that. But that's a huge, huge discovery. When we think about these New Testament books, there is, on the whole, more information about these. Maybe just thinking about the time frame. 2,000 years, that's a long time ago. But then, you know, you think about a book like Genesis or Exodus. When did that start getting written? And we don't have as much on some of those Old Testament books as what's known about, you know, some of the Newer Testament books. This was a verse that we referenced this morning in Colossians chapter 4 and verse 16. When this letter is read among you, have it also read in the church of the Laodiceans. And you, for your part, read my letter that's coming from Laodicea. How would they have done this? One way could be to just travel. You know, somebody from one church says, well, I've got this letter, and now we're going to let you have our, you know, we'll let you have our letter, you let us have your letter, that kind of a thing. Maybe some of that went on. What else could you have done? You could have copied it, which in those times was what people did and was perfectly acceptable. Today, we start to have concerns about copyright laws and plagiarizing. I'm sure all of our teachers and education people here want to make sure that your students aren't plagiarizing and violating copyrights and all of that. In ancient times, that wasn't a concern. If you wanted a book, how are you going to get that book? You can't order it on Amazon or go to the local library or, you know, go online somewhere and find a PDF. Somebody's going to have to copy that. And they're going to have to do it by hand. This is how ancient libraries were built. The ones that were in existence is somebody would copy. And that was the job of a scribe, was to copy. I can remember being in the third grade and having Mrs. Butler. And Mrs. Butler was just all about handwriting. You know, you have to write, you have to write. And I can remember filling up a page in a notebook and just thinking, oh, you know, my hand is cramping and it's hurting. And, you know, please don't make me write anymore. You stop and think about somebody sitting down and copying the Gospel of Matthew, copying the book of Revelation. This was a huge undertaking. This was a big task. This would have been tedious sort of work that people were trained to do. So, when we think about our New Testament books, we don't have what people would refer to as the autograph, as the original, the letter that Paul wrote to Rome. That's not in a museum anywhere. It's not anywhere that we have. What we do have are copies of the copies of the copies of the copies. So you would start off with an original writing, and then somebody would copy it. Somebody would copy it by hand. And then somebody else would copy it. And then maybe a person associated with a church in another region would copy it. And then maybe some other group would have opportunity to copy it. And then some time would pass and some people would make some copies of that first copy. And then in another area, people would make some copies of that copy. And copies of this copy and copies of that copy. For a while, it was thought that there were basically four. You could kind of separate the copies, the manuscripts, by sort of four family trees based on the area and the region. And so people would talk about the Alexandrian manuscripts and the Byzantine manuscripts. And so if you've seen a family tree, I think that's kind of a helpful way to think about it, is you've got, the patriarch or the matriarch, and then you have people that come off of there, and then you've got people that come off of here and people that come off of there, you know, and there's, I think that's kind of a way to at least help us a little bit to think about some of this. And when people start comparing the copies of the copies, here and there, there's variance. There's some variation. And so if you have some notes in your Bible that will say, You know, some early manuscripts read this way, or an alternative reading is this. There's some variation in some of these. So is that something that we should be concerned about? Is that problematic? Is that something to worry about? A few reasons why some of these might vary. One, it's been observed that sometimes in documents, there was these handwritten documents, there can be more variation closer to the end of it, assuming that people's hands might have gotten more tired, their handwriting might get a little sloppier, their eyes might be getting tired. Let's say you sit down to copy the Gospel of Matthew. You're probably pretty good there in the beginning. In chapter 1, verse 1, you get to what we call chapter 28, and your handwriting might slip a little bit. There might be some things that are a little bit more difficult for the next person who's copying your copy to read and decipher. Sometimes a copyist, a scribe, might make some sort of a mistake. And in the first century times, if there's a mistake, sometimes there would be a marginal note to explain something or have an explanation of something. I can remember in school writing so you'd be writing something, you would make a mistake, and you would use this little thing, and then you would write more back up here. I left something out, or something was left out. I don't know if that's still practice or not, but that sort of a thing. And in ancient times, they had their little symbols and things that would say, this should have gone here. And so you have the copyists doing that, and then somebody else looks at their copy, and there can be some things that sometimes don't line up exactly and that sort of thing. Really, what their job was to make the best possible copy that they could. And thinking about who were these people? Who were these scribes, these copyists? Probably were people from within the churches, which is an interesting thing to think about. Let's say that we are in Rome and we get Paul's letter. And what's expected is that we'll make a copy, we'll keep it, and so we assign somebody to copy it. If we're in a situation of persecution, what's the likelihood that we're going to take our document up to the Roman courthouse, so to speak, and say, hey, we got this document from Paul. I'm from the church over here. We got this letter. We were wondering if you had someone who's a professional scribe who could copy this letter for us. You're probably not going to do that. And so many of these copyists were probably in-house sort of people. Maybe those who were bookkeepers. One of the tasks of slaves of that time was sometimes to keep records, to copy, to be bookkeepers, to be sort of like an accountant. Those sorts of people. They did a very good job. It's not like they were inadequate for the task. So that's just something kind of on the side to think about. Another way that sometimes variants will come in is through names or places. And the way that I thought about trying to illustrate this was with my own name. Again, the job of the scribe was to try to produce the best possible document that they could. Looking at something that somebody else wrote by hand, now they're going to try to make the best possible copy. So my name is Brian Allen. For some reason, people get weird talking about their middle names. I don't know why we're all embarrassed of our middle names. But my middle name is Allen, two A's, two L's. You would not believe how many documents, how many official sorts of things that I've seen or that have come in the mail where this has been spelled all sorts of ways, where some well-intending person tried to make a correction or either read something wrong or it was in handwriting and they looked at it wrong. So it's been corrected before to Ryan. Well, I've never seen it with a Y before, but I've seen Ryan, so it must be Ryan. I've, of course, gotten Brian. And I've even gotten mail before addressed to Brain, which makes you feel smart. You know, it makes you feel intelligent. But they, you know, somebody tries to fix it by adding an I, and then they themselves apparently make a mistake and get the letter switched, and I've gotten letters for Brain. But thinking about my middle name, you know, that's been corrected before to Allen with one L. It's been corrected with Allen with an E. People who look at it and they say, well, I thought it was this. Back in the days of handwriting, especially, certainly those kinds of things could occur, or somebody's more familiar with a certain spelling than another spelling. So I tried to illustrate it this way. Maybe it's not quite as visible as I thought it would be. For those who can see it, I've tried to write this in a way where you have to take a guess of whether it is fable or table. Is that fable or is that table? There's not really a right answer. I just tried to come up with something. But if you were copying something and you came across something like this, what do? You have to make a choice, and you have to try to make a choice based on the context of which of these would make the best sense. I could probably come up with some sentences where fable and table both fit pretty well, and you would have to make a choice on that. Sometimes in our Bibles, you might have a footnote that will say, you know, an alternate reading is this, or a variant, you know, word here is this. And in our English language, it looks like it's just worlds apart. Like it's just two completely different things. Well, how can it be this or this? Those words aren't even related. But if you're looking at Greek or you're looking at Hebrew, what has happened is there's maybe a letter, and you change that one letter, and now you've got a different word. So things like that happen. When we think about the manuscripts that we do have regarding the New Testament, there's over 5,000 fragments, copies of New Testament writings. So up here on the screen, I think I counted it earlier, and I think it was 17. But imagine that there's over, and now I'm sure everybody's going to count, but imagine that there's over 5,000 and something up there, almost 6,000 up there. On the one hand, some people who are skeptical will look at that and say, well, how out of all of that could you ever produce, you know, any sort of a reasonable and readable text? When really just the opposite is true. That's the very reason that there can be a text that's very, with great precision, very, very close to the original. Think about if we were all in a classroom, and let's say a teacher put something up on a board. Let's say there's 300 of us, and a teacher put something up on a board and says, I want you to copy this by hand and then turn it in. Maybe it's a paragraph. And so the 300 students copy it by hand and then turn it in. within that, inevitably, there's going to be some variation. There's going to be somebody who jumps over a word, somebody who misses a word, somebody whose eyes play a trick on them and they skip a line. But if you were somebody on the outside and you looked at these 300 papers that had been turned in, you could take the time from those 300 to pretty much get what was on the board. You're going to be able to sort through the variants, sort through the places where there's variation, and figure out with pretty great precision, this is what originally was on the board. The more copies you have, the greater precision that you can have in doing that. Let's say now that you're in a classroom of three people. And the same scenario. Teachers put something up on the board, says copy it, turn it in. And you look at these three copies. And within these three copies, there's some differences. Well, now it's a whole lot more difficult. Because you don't have that large pool to be looking at and to be surveying and comparing. You've only got a few. And so the more that we have, and there's always more and more being found through archaeology. The more that we have, the more precision that we can have. One other thing that I wanted to try to do before we finish, and I'll see how this works. Okay, so one of the interesting things is we're talking about, the little blue circles on the screen representing the copies of the copies. There's now getting to be great databases that are available to the public that you can go and look these up. And I think it's just a really fascinating thing. So let's go down to, let's say we want to see what New Testament manuscripts there are in the United States. So we'll select the USA. We'll go down here and search. Now it shows us all the manuscripts that are in the United States. The P stands for papyrus, which is a reference to the type of material that it was written on. So let's say that we're curious about P9. Okay, P9, it's assumed to be, and I'm sure this is very small writing for some of you, between 200 and 299, so believed to have been in the 3rd century, and some of that is dated by the type of handwriting. The type of handwriting, where it was found, what it was found with, those sorts of things. It's kept at Harvard. Let's see. Maybe that one. Oh, here it is. And you can go down and see if they have a picture of it. You can see a picture. So I don't know what everybody's interests are, what you think is interesting, but I think that this is a pretty fascinating thing. That this is, and I think it, if you go, I didn't look, if you go back, it'll tell you what verses it is. That this is from the 3rd century, and it's a piece, I think it's of Romans 1, that was found. And so what we have are these fragments, these pieces from different dates, different times. And the task then is to collect all of these and discern what did the original say. Just like if you were reading 300 handwritten papers that had been turned in, what did the original thing say? And then once that's pretty well determined, then now how can we get that into another language? How can we make that communicate for English-speaking people today? How about for people in Africa? How about for people who speak German? And so there's a Greek text, and then from there, how do we translate it? And we'll talk about that more in coming weeks. I know I've taken a lot of time tonight, and we'll go ahead and conclude there. All right, so again, thank you for my time. I know I went a little longer tonight than what I usually do. But this was meant to just sort of be an introduction to the topic. And then what I want us to look at in coming weeks is, because we are English-speaking people, what translations have been made available in English? From some very, very old ones to some more contemporary ones with our time, some newer ones. And that's what we'll look at over the next few Sunday nights. So appreciate you all being here and your attention tonight. The scriptures, as we've been talking about, we confess that they are that. It's not just a book like any other book, but it's Holy Bible. It's a book unlike other books because this is God's communication to us. And if you're here tonight and you need to begin your relationship with Him in baptism, or if you have been baptized and there's anything else that we can assist you with, we'd love to be able to tonight. So if you would, please come forward as we stand and sing.